are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome, all you weirdos, not quite dead yet multiversal saber teeth, and everyone who thinks Ben Percy's deep voice sounds super sexy. It is time for your 88th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your weird science family. I am your magical axe-wielding host, Jason, broadcasting as always from the Wrong Turn Studio, high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And here with me, showing off his new blinged-out Mysterium Knuckle Dusters, is my pal, Ruben. So, that's about enough of that. I did listen to an interview Ben Percy did on the Comic Pop Returns YouTube channel. Have you ever heard this guy talk, Ruben? It's amazing. His voice is super deep and resonant. And like the top 30 comments are all just people saying, wow, what a great voice he has. So
he's basically Matt Razor is what you're telling me.
It's pretty similar. It's kind of in the same family thing. Yeah. Like they could maybe long lost voice cousins, if that's a thing. So if the writing gig ever dries up, Ben Percy could transition to doing like monster truck voiceovers. Sunday, 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 Memorial Coliseum, monster trucks, all that good stuff. Oh, you also get to hear him do an impression of Jonathan Hickman's Southern drawl, but in his deep, Ben Percy voice. Great stuff. So, yeah, I mean, and again, you should go check that out over on the Comic Pop Returns YouTube channel. And, you know, while you're there, subscribe to Weird Science YouTube and see all the stuff Jim's been doing over there. But, you know, that's other nonsense. For this week's nonsense, we have a lot of books that came out this week. We're only going to talk about three of them today. Those are Invincible Iron Man number 15, Dead X-Men number 2, and Wolverine number 44. We're going to hold Cable number 2 and Resurrection of Magneto number 2 until next episode. So, hey, folks, if that's what you're here for, sorry, just got to wait a week. Ruben, you ready to jump right on into Iron Man? Let's do it. It is Invincible Iron Man number 15, written by Jerry Duggan, pencils by Kreese Lee, three E's in Kreese. That's a lot of E's. He's also the artist on Giant Size Fantastic Four, which came out this week. Not an artist I'm really familiar with, but looks pretty good. Inks by Walden Wong, colors by Brian Valenza, and letters by Joe Caramagna. So the cover and the solicit here both feature Mr. James Rhodey Rhodes, but he does not actually appear in the comic. I don't know if that's marketing shenanigans, schedules getting messed up with this whole kind of accelerated publishing schedule. Hard to say. Were you excited to see what's up with Rhodey in this issue?
He's still in prison, right?
He's still in prison, last we know. He's being protected by those people that Tony sent to protect him. And he was sent like a miniaturized version of the War Machine armor, right? And we haven't seen him for a while. We've been concentrating on all this other, you know, X-Men related stuff. We got to get Rhodey out of jail sometime. While we don't get any Rhodey this issue, what we do get is another Tony-Emma relationship scene, followed by a fight scene, followed by the real reason most of us X-fans are even reading this book, which is the big Fei-Long moment referenced in Fall of the House of X number 2. So Duggan starts us off by reinforcing that idea that the whole sham marriage between Tony and Emma might be growing into something more than a sham. They say some nice things to each other, Tony gives Emma a gift to be opened later, and they share a kiss. Tony's narration tells us that he took the kiss as the start of the end of their relationship. Now, that's not what the rest of the panel seem to be pointing towards, though, right? I think Tony's being like unduly pessimistic here. He's had a rough history. Maybe he's just trying to protect himself. Is that how you read this?
I don't know, man. I actually thought maybe they're just going to say this was nice, but time to move on.
That's what he's getting ready for. I don't know. The rest of it seems to be going for more than that. I hope it's more than that. Well, we've enjoyed this relationship, and it could be good going forward. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I guess I'm ultimately a pessimist, too.
Apparently, you and Tony, two peas in a pod.
Yeah.
So as soon as Emma drives off, we jump right into the big fight scene of the issue. It's yet another of those discarded Logan skeletons turned into a killer robot, which felt super cool and fresh the first, I don't know, dozen times we saw it. And now it's just, okay, one of these again. The fandom wiki calls these things Sentinel Zeros. Have you seen that term or remember seeing that term in the actual comics? Because I don't.
No, that's something people have totally made up.
Okay, it's a pretty cool name, but it's fine.
I don't know. Yeah.
This Sentinel Zero.
It's an okay name, but until I see it on the paper. Although probably the writers will just look at the wiki and be like, oh yeah, of course that's what it's called.
Yeah, usually the stuff in the wiki comes from somewhere, but I just can't remember. Maybe it was buried in one of the first appearances and I just didn't notice. So this Sentinel goes after some disposable Hellfire Knights, and then goes after Tony, who fends it off with a bottle of booze, you know, for the irony, and then some fire, which may cause some trouble for him down the line, because it looks like he sets the whole Hellfire place on, you know, hellfire. It could be bad down the road. Kingpin tosses Tony that Mysterium cane that he made, and we think, okay, here's this Mysterium cane that's going to be the magic bullet, allows Tony to beat the Sentinel, but Duggan pulls a switcheroo and has the Sentinel knock the cane right out of Tony's hands. I guess Mysterium is extra slippery.
Yeah.
Tony's about to die, but fortunately, Emma realizes that she had forgotten something, namely that Chekhov's gun of a wedding present, and she rides in diamond form to come to Tony's rescue. So she kind of holds the Sentinel at bay while Tony hobbles off to put on his new armor. This Sentinel is actually way smarter than any Sentinel we've seen in a while, because it finds the inhibitor ring, right? Sentinels usually just, you know, smash, you know, and get beat by something.
Yeah.
But this one is able to figure out, oh, there's an inhibitor ring. And if I put this inhibitor ring on, you know, diamond form Emma, she won't be diamond anymore. It'll be a whole lot easier to smash her. And of course, right before it goes on her finger, Tony flies into the rescue. We get our full page splash of the Mark 72 Mysterium armor, which it looks fine. That's about as far as I go. What did you think of this armor?
Yeah, it's cool enough. It's the color scheme is a little weird, so I was like, this isn't going to stick. But,
but yeah, it leans heavily towards the black, with a decent bit of red and just a little bit of that goldy orange color that usually is all over the Iron Man armor for highlights. It's fine. It's got some weird bulges in the forearm area, like old baseball player Steve Garvey. People remember him. He had really big forearms, like Popeye. So we get shown just how strong Mysterium is. The Sentinel's adamantium claws don't even leave a mark on it, and then Tony squishes the thing's adamantium skull right between his two Mysterium armored hands. So, like everything else in the Marvel Universe, anytime you introduce a new thing, you have to show how it's even bigger and stronger than all the old things. So, Mysterium trumps adamantium. After the big fight, we get a second semi-anticlimactic shorter fight, one that allows us to see what Tony's present to Emma really was. It's a set of brass knuckles. How romantic. The right one reads H-E-L. I guess maybe you got that backwards. One of them reads H-E-L-L, and the other one says F-I-R-E, Hellfire. Oh, and they shoot, I presume these are standard Iron Man repulsor beams. So when a regular old Stark Sentinel challenges the happy couple as they leave the Hellfire Club, the two of them is taken out in one panel. Hey, Ruba, do you remember when the Stark Sentinels were an actual threat? Wasn't that cool when they were, like, hard to beat?
They got to shoot something other than just a repulsor beam, because you'd think that that at least would be that Fei Long would have devised a way to, like, you know, avoid damage from that.
I guess. It doesn't say anything else, though. And if I see an Iron Man armor shooting a beam, I'm going to assume it's a repulsor beam until told otherwise. Weird wedding gift, too, though, right? Personalized brass knuckles. Visually, they seem inspired by Kitty Pryde's hold fast knuckle tattoos. At least that's what I thought of.
Yeah, I did too.
Does Kitty still have those? We haven't seen those in a while.
Yeah, she's got it, right? She didn't die. Well, I don't know.
I don't think she's been resurrected since then.
Yeah.
I think she's wearing that Shadow Cat costume now, which maybe that has gloves that covers up her hands. I don't even remember.
Yeah, or the artists are just embarrassed.
You're a real crumb bum.
Now Tony's off to Australia. We remember that Orcus was duped into sending every Stark Sentinel on Earth, I mean, I guess other than the one that just got beat up outside the Hellfire Club, every other Stark Sentinel on Earth got sent to Australia because that's where they were told the invading Iraqi mutants would be landing, in those ships made by Ironheart and Forge. Turns out, no Iraqi mutants were in those ships at all. Like the escape pod at the start of Star Wars, zero life signs detected. Now, Fei Long, up on the doomed Orcus Petal space station, he realizes he's been duped, and he runs off to take his frustrations out on Tony. So this is what Dr. Stasis was complaining about at the very start of Fall of the House of X number 2. It finally caught up, and that's why Fei Long wasn't part of that battle on the space station. And before he goes, Fei Long straps himself into his own new bit of technology, which is a War Machine Sentinel, giant robot that he gets inside of. Now, it seems odd to me to even call it a Sentinel when it's being piloted by a guy inside the armor. Aren't Sentinels generally autonomous robots?
Yes. That's why they're all different sizes, right? It's not like you're a Sentinel just because you're big, but...
Right, it's an AI sort of a thing, either low-level AI, like the Stark Sentinels, or all the way on up to Omega Sentinel and Nimrod. But it's a cool word. I guess they just want to take that cool word and use it another way. That's a very Marvel thing to do, is just they have like 6 or 7 different cool words, and they put them in every possible combination, and this one gets to be War Machine Sentinel. Anyway, in a move that will not surprise listeners to this podcast, because we totally called it, the Mysterium ships landing in Australia, not ships at all, really just a disassembled Voltron-style robot.
Yeah. And more specific, I'll say you called that one. Let's be fair. That was you.
I wasn't going to, you know, take the credit, but if you say so, yes. Yes, I called. I'm pretty sure a lot of people called it, but yeah, I could tell it looked like a robot to me.
Yeah, I just was like, okay, fine, spaceships, but... they're Voltron. Why not? Mm-hmm.
They're Voltron, and they're not really, again, they're not really a robot because they're a set of armor for Tony to wear. It's his second new set of armor in one issue, which I'm not a collector, but I think that makes this worth $1 million. Isn't that how that works? Put this in some Lucite and never read it, and you get $1 million. And I don't understand collectors. But this armor is called the Sentinel Buster. Now, Ruben, I think you may have called that name the last time we talked about this, when we were discussing what was going to happen.
Yeah.
So, a little better for you, too.
There's only so many things that Tony Stark does, right?
Just like he makes words, they stick together. Sentinel and Buster. Gotta make a Sentinel Buster.
Yes. Is this better than the Hulk Buster? I'm assuming it is, right?
It's way bigger, it seems, because it totally dwarfs all of these Stark Sentinels around it, right? The Stark Sentinels, hard to tell perspective, you know, foreground, background, but they're definitely like knee level to this Sentinel Buster armor. So that's got to be really friggin' huge. So this has got to be the end of the Stark Sentinels, right? Tony's going to wipe them all out, and we won't see them again once all the timelines from the various issues catch up to each other. Well, that'll be good. I mean, they were cool to have around for a while. They were a threat. And then they kind of turned to not a threat, so it's time to get rid of him. And we are getting set up for that final showdown with Fei Long, who's the villain who's taken over Tony's company, been making Tony's life difficult this entire volume, even when we didn't really know who it was always Fei Long. So it'll be nice to have that kind of come to a conclusion, probably about the same time as, maybe even before all the actual X stuff come to a conclusion. The Kreasley art is really damn good, I'd say. He hasn't done a ton of Marvel work before, but he sure knows how to draw armor. The character and facial work, I don't think he put as much time and effort into that, maybe, because, hey, this is an Iron Man book with 2 new armors and 1 new War Machine Sentinel. That's where his priorities were. It was making this armor look as cool as possible, and it looks really freaking cool. This is a pretty simple, straightforward action-adventure comic book issue. No fancy writing techniques, no intercutting scenes. Just a little bit of romance, some fights, cool art, and a cliffhanger. Simple but effective, maybe a little light on substance. Not my favorite kind of book, but, you know, pretty successful at being what it is. So I can't go quite as high as an 8, but I'm giving it a positive 7.8 out of 10. How about you?
Yeah, I'm just going to go 7. Negative Nancy over here.
Negative Ruben.
But it's a positive 7, like you said. It just doesn't do anything. It's like... the most generic Iron Man story ever, right? Iron Man creates some new armors, and he gets ready to fight a bad guy who also has a cool new armor.
It doesn't break any new ground, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the art looks cool. I think the Emma relationship pushes it up a little bit over standard issue, and I think some of the X tie-ins pushes it up just a little bit above, there's another Iron Man issue, at least for me.
Yeah. I would reevaluate this based on whether or not his sort of pessimism about the relationship ending is just pessimism, or if it's like, oh yeah, we're getting ready to put that to bed, but we shall see.
We shall see indeed. And now we're going to see what's going on with those dead X-Men in Dead X-Men number 2, Army of Me, written by Steve Fox, art by Peter Nguyen, Bernard Chang, and Guillermo Sana, probably Sana, which seems like a lot of artists, but they each get their own timeline to illustrate. Which I think that's cool. I like the way that looks. Colors are all by Frank Martin. Letters by Corey Pettit. Now, last issue, our team of dead X-Men, who are literally the team of X-Men who were elected and then killed by Nimrod at the Hellfire Gala, they had been resurrected and were sent on a vital mission into the Moira engine timelines. Their job, find a still human Moira, have Prodigy download her memories, then send that info back to Professor X so that he can go back in time and talk with young Moira before her powers awaken. this mission was fully, completely, 100% successful in issue one. So why the heck is there even an issue two? Well, in the process of getting that vital information, they accidentally gave the version of Moira in the Moira Engine timelines a little bit of Mysterium, which happened to be the last little bit she needed to create her own timeline-hopping device. Oops. And hers is way cooler than theirs because it's also this big badass war axe she calls Weapon M, which is once again Marvel taking some names from their history and just squishing them together. You got your Weapon X, you got your House of M, the Moira, Weapon M. There you go. Surely will be no negative repercussions from Moira getting this this magical axe. So issue two opens with negative repercussions. Moira told us last time that she wanted to use this Weapon M to travel all the way back to her very first life, start all over, and make sure that this time, quote, Moira always wins. She's not quite there yet. She's revisiting her eighth life, which is the one where she teamed up with Magneto. She gets there by using her axe to slice her way into this reality. I like the way this is drawn. You can actually see, like, the tear in reality. It almost feels like there was a Doctor Who bit that had this tear in reality that it reminds me. So Moira then proceeds to kill a group of Magneto lackeys. Tower and Mentallo, they're both quite dead. Not sure about Toad, Quill, and Stinger, but they're certainly having a bad day. Moira then slices another hole out of this reality and proceeds on her merry way. Now, Ruben, I'm not sure what Axe Moira was trying to accomplish here. Did she have to do this, or is she just, does she have to go through her lives backwards one by one to get to life number one, and she just, you know, has killing these guys for fun along the route? What is she really doing here?
Maybe she has a vendetta against them.
She's got a vendetta against a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah, but maybe they're, like, responsible for the timeline failing. But I gathered that it was more like she was just passing through and decided to kill some people. Yeah, exactly.
She can't jump directly the way Rachel can send, you know, the group of dead X-Men kind of to wherever she wants in just one jump. It seems like, I almost think of it like a stack of books. If you're cutting your way down to issue one on the bottom, I guess she has to cut her way down life by life by life. Pretty cool little conceit there. Okay, that's about the last we see of Moira in this issue, although she does get mentioned later. So scene two, the dead X-Men, they're back on Atlantic Krakoa inside the White Hot Room. This team, of course, is Jubilee, Prodigy, Frenzy, Cannonball, and Dazzler, with Rachel appearing via psychic Zoom call from the No Place on a waterfall, which again is one of those sentences that I can't believe I just said out loud, but hey, X-Men comics. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of brain cells between all of them, other than Prodigy, and he's arguably kind of distracted himself since having a chunk of Micron crystal lodged in his chest from that mishap last issue. This team's current mission is to sit on their dead X asses and wait for Professor X and his No Place team to do their thing, which sounds like a great mission to me because I'm lazy. But Prodigy, he's not content to just sit and wait. He points out to Rachel that there are some other timelines of interest, not the Moira Engine ones, the Moira's past lives ones. He paints this as an intelligence gathering opportunity. Maybe someone in one of those lives knew how to stop a Dominion. That'll be handy to learn. Rachel isn't so crazy about the idea, and she's not even sure if she can do it, but she's kind of distracted by an attack on the No Place, which I figure this must be the Arachno Sentinels from Rise of the Powers of X number 2. I think that's what's lining up. So Rachel is all like, yeah, I don't have time for this, whatever. She zaps the team of eager doofuses off into Moira's seventh life. And it was way easy after all her talk of, hey, those lives are more distant from ours and they're not connecting the same way. It goes there no problem, which I think it's going to turn out that the Micron crystal in Prodigy's chest is kind of connected here. Isn't that the feeling you're getting?
Yeah, yeah. And he talks about how at some point he should be suffering, but seems to not be suffering anymore.
Right. He got his, why? There were blocks in his mind kind of limiting his powers because he was being overwhelmed by the psychic information flooding in. Those blocks got taken out so he could do his Moira thing, which was really overwhelming to him when he was around, you know, more than like three people at a time. But now he says, hey, it's not really bothering me. I seem to have it under control, which has got to be the crystal thing. Steve Fox is going to play that card another issue or two, and we're going to see something's up with Prodigy. Okay, so they are off to Moira's seventh life. We saw a little bit of this life in House of X number 2. It's the one where Moira tried to stop the creation of Sentinels by killing everyone whose last name even rhymed with Trask. Just every last one. This timeline is pretty messed up. It's basically a giant riot in DC with Ultron Sentinels trying to round up mutants. The dead X-Men help rescue this timeline's Emma, who's just trying to protect her students. Emma gives this team, and hence us, a psychic view into just what went wrong here. There was a government hearing, which included Emma, Hank Pym, and Henry Gyrich, investigating just why all those Trasks have been turning up dead. Hank Pym blames it all on, quote, radical mutant terrorism, which outrages Emma, but he's right, isn't he? I mean, there are a lot of mutants more radical than Life 7 Moira MacTaggert, so
yeah.
Good call there, Hank. The hearing is then interrupted by an even more radical mutant, Axe Moira, who pops in, gleefully murders Gyrich to death, and then pops back out. Again, is this part of her plan? Does she have to murder him for things to happen? Or, again, probably just target of opportunity. If you can kill Henry Peter Gyrich, you always kill Henry Peter Gyrich.
Yes. Yes.
So, the version of Emma that's giving the psychic projection then dies in Jubilee's arms, getting her out of the way. And our team of merry morons realizes that it's their own doing that has resulted in this crazy lady marauding through all of time and space. And they know where she's going, her very first life, because Moira very conveniently said so when she was in that meeting. Maybe a strategic error on her part. So this team decides they darn well better find her first and, quote, put her down by any means necessary. So that was our comic. And Ruben, what did you think of this book overall while I have a little bit of my tea here?
I actually enjoyed it more than I expected. And the reason was that I thought it was a nice way to show all universe versions of X-Men in a way that sort of matters, but also you can kind of just breeze through it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew these lives existed, right? And we had like a rough understanding of like the type of stuff that might be in these lives.
Yeah, we got glimpses of them back in Hoxpox when the whole idea of these multiple Moira timelines was just overwhelming and super cool.
Yeah. So a lot of times you'll have these sort of stories where it's like, hey, let's show a what-if universe, right? And it's sort of like, why does it matter at all? And the other bit that's sort of interesting to me about this is these are the pasts of present-day Moira, right? So, and she always takes with her the knowledge of what happened in the past. So there's stakes, right? Like you change this past, sort of back to the future, right? Like you actually change these things. Does that mean that something is impacted in the present? It feels like it matters
more. That's
a
really darn good question, because the only person in the, I guess what we're going to call the real timeline, for lack of a better word, the only person in the real timeline who has any memory, like real memory of this, is Moira, who remembers all these lifetimes. So are her memories going to change based on this, and are her changing memories going to change her actions going forward? But she's so motivated by, you know, wanting to live forever, wanting to, you know, get to, you know, this post-AI or whatever it takes for her to keep surviving. Maybe this changes her thought processes.
Yeah. So cool. I think that actually matters and is interesting. And then, so there's like a stakes right here. Mm-hmm. But it's also, it works, it's self-contained, right? Each of these lives happens and ends. And so you can kind of mess it up and it doesn't really prevent the, you know, 10th life from happening.
Yeah. The dead X-Men talk about that a little bit, how they're kind of popping in shortly before the timeline just stops existing. Like there's this timeline's Moira is existing somewhere off panel. Otherwise the timeline wouldn't exist because the timeline doesn't continue after she dies. So there's no way to actually say what happens in 5, 10, 20 years. There is no 20 years forward from here. And there's even some little ethical discussion though, you know, so what does it mean to save someone in this timeline when we all know they're just going to stop existing a month from now, maybe. It's kind of a cool idea. There's no answer to it because there can't be an answer to it, but it's fun that they brought it up.
Yeah. So the dead X-Men themselves are a little dopey. That kind of annoys me, but it's not the, I'm going to get canceled for saying this, but it's not the sharpest X-Men team. I actually thought the collection of this group was kind of lame, right? Looking at them, I was like,
yes. Now I wanted to talk about that too, because, you know, I know you're not on the Twitters anymore, which is probably for the best. But I poke around on the X-Spoilers hashtag just to see what people are talking about. And at least in that context, there's a lot of people taking this team super seriously. Oh, this is the best team ever. They're heroes. I'm so glad we finally get to see them be X-Men. They are the real X-Men team. Where I don't think we're supposed to take them that way. I think Steve Fox knows that this was a team put together just to be annoying on one panel and then get killed on the next panel. And I think it's supposed to be kind of campy. A little bit, you know, wink, wink, they're kind of dumb.
They are kind of dumb. I mean, these are important. I shouldn't say important, but these are characters that we all love, right? But we've never loved them because they were natural born leaders, right? Like, you look at this group and Sam Guthrie is like a country bumpkin, right? Jubilee is kind of an airhead. Dazzler's a party girl. Prodigy's sort of self-absorbed, right? Like, he always thinks he's great, but was he actually done? And I don't know much about Frenzy, so...
She's tall. I know that about Frenzy.
She's tall and strong, right? But yeah, I'm like, who's the clever person that's going to get the team rallied behind them, right? I'm happy to see them trying, right? Their heart's all in the right place, but... I don't know what you would have done with
it has
X-Men
almost
if
like,
these were the core characters for
almost like an old like 1940s movie where, you know, we need to put on a show to save the orphanage kind of a tone to it. Which, you know, They're not bad, but they're just kinda doofy. And I'm enjoying that, and at least I'm thinking it's on purpose. At least that's how I'm taking it.
Yeah. And then lastly I'll say art wise, I kinda like this art.
Yeah.
It's I don't know how to explain it, but it's sort of an old style. Like, kind of...
Which art are you talking about? Because we got three different styles by three different artists.
Yeah,
I don't know
really,
which is which.
Yeah, I don't know either. But it looks a little cartoony when it's... I guess it's not the early... The earlier stuff is more generic, but later it becomes more like a Sunday morning newspaper strip style. And I towards the back end. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I really like the very beginning part. That quick look at Life 8. It has an old-fashioned kind of feel. You can even see like the Ben Day dots from the 1970s style comic printing presses look to it. I thought that looked really cool. So yeah, I like it when art looks different and there's a reason for it. And it's not just, oh, the artist ran out of time, we had to hire somebody else. I like when comics use the art to convey something going on. And like you say, this might end up being an important book. It could affect, you know, how the robot Moira functions. It could end up, you know, we're all heading back to meet Moira in her first life. Maybe Professor X realizes maybe his secret third plan is also going back to see Moira in her first life, which, you know, I predicted that, so I'm still clinging to it. Maybe everybody's going to end up in the same place, and, you know, if we're going to erase this whole entire bit of X-Men continuity, let's go out with a bang. A fun book, some cool stuff, some fun characters, maybe a little meta commentary, and the team that shouldn't have existed is now doing something that maybe they shouldn't be doing. I had so much fun with the cool art. I'm giving it an 8.5 out of 10.
Nice. Yeah. I'm always, excuse me. I'm always a little under you, but this one is my book of the week for sure. Sexy. And it's probably more like 8.2, 8.3 for me, but I really liked it. I'm enjoying this story that Steve Fox is telling. And I guess that's another Steve Fox story that kind of makes me look up and wonder, like, hey, does he have a bunch of other stories? So I actually might go back and read that House of whatever X,
the 1997 thing.
Yeah, I didn't have any interest in that when I just read the previews, but I enjoy his stories enough that it makes me think maybe I should pick that up.
Yeah, if you do, let us know what you think about it. I'm sure people will be curious to hear.
If nothing else, it's one of those things where I feel like he'll somehow weave that into the story. Yeah, we're not going to notice.
We're doing multiversal timelines. Anything could show up anywhere, right? McCran Crystal, I don't got to explain anything. There it is. It happened. But one more book for us to talk about this week, and that is Wolverine number 44, Sabretooth War Part 4, written by Benjamin Percy and Victor Laval, pencils by Corey Smith, inks by Oren Jr., who they have been my favorite art team on this book because it's going back and forth. But I like the look of this issue, I think, more than the other stuff. There's some cool pictures here. Colors are all by Alex Sinclair, letters by Corey Pettit. And we get a reminder, of course, that this whole arc takes place after X-Force number 50, which hasn't come out yet, and before Fall of the House of X number 1, which came out 2 months ago. So again, publishing schedule, something's gone wrong. There's a lot of rumors about how the end of the Krakoan era was kind of accelerated to try to get to this new Tom Brevoort thing.
Yeah.
And I have zero inside sources on that, but it kind of seems that way from the way the books are coming out. I, you know, it doesn't argue against it. And Ruben, have you noticed which X-Force team member does not appear in any of these Sabretooth War issues.
I'm guessing it's Omega Red.
It is Omega Red. He usually doesn't say anything, but he's generally at least drawn into the background. We haven't seen him at all. So
Yeah. Maybe
something happens to him in X-Force number 50.
Oh, no.
Wait and see. I got to see what happens with my man, my favorite X character of all time, Omega Red. So this is very much an aftermath kind of issue. The aftermath of the Sabretooth attack on Krakoa farther north that happened in issue 42. Two issues ago, and that resulted in the deaths of several mutants, including Logan's son, Akihiro, and also Lobster Lad. I've decided that guy's name was Lobster Lad, and he was also a member of the Legion of Superheroes. That's my headcanon. So the first matter to be dealt with, Logan's missing limbs. Remember that he was all tied up by the saber teeth, had to free himself by shedding his hands and feet the way a salamander sheds a tail. Now, some poor mutant had the awful job of going and retrieving those bloody appendages, bringing them to the medical bay, where Logan is reassembled by Dr. Aurora and Nurse Northstar. The speed of Logan's healing factor has always been variable, depending on the needs of the story. I would have thought his hands and feet would have started to grow back by now. It's never really been super set in stone, so... Ben Percy gets to give us one of his body horror gross out scenes by having these limbs just kind of, stuck onto the end and sewn up a little bit. That's fine. Aurora is very upset herself. She's saying that she had been in love with Akihiro, which I had forgotten all about, but that did happen in the pages of Leah Williams' X-Factor title, which I've mostly successfully wiped from my brain. But that did happen there. Logan, on the other hand, he's decided to sidestep the whole sad business and stick with angry. He's good at angry. That angry can be put to immediate use because Domino comes into the medbay and tells him, we've got a runner. Now, Ruben, who is this runner? Who is running away from Krakoa farther north?
Yeah, it's the Captain America Sabretooth, but it doesn't exactly make sense to me because I thought he was dead, but I guess he got better.
Yeah, I looked back at that and there's one panel two issues ago where he's laying on the ground looking very dead. And the rest of the team, the real Sabretooth and all the other Sabretooth say, hey, this is when all the Krakoan tech starts attacking them. They say, we got to get out of here. Leave the dead. We're bugging out. And we have been told repeatedly, including in the series, that Sabretooth is hard to kill. So it kind of makes sense to me. It works out okay that, yeah, things were busy. They didn't notice that he kind of healed up and snuck out the door. Now, last issue, I had said that, hey, he wasn't crossed out in the list of characters in that whole title page. And I even said I thought it might be an editorial error. So, not an error. He's just not dead.
Yeah.
Let's see. So, once again, we have somebody running away from Krakoa further north, which makes me laugh because we just saw Bronze Age Beast do that. And Bronze Age Beast got all the way to rainy Los Angeles. So, I was wondering if, Saber Cap was going to also get to rainy Los Angeles, but not so much. They send a team of X-Force folks out to catch him, and I would have thought you might want to use one of your two Canadian speedsters here, right? Aurora and Northstar, they're both super fast, they know all about being up in polar areas, the whole Canadian thing, but no. The team that gets sent out is Logan, Colossus, and Domino, and how are our team of badasses traveling, Ruben?
I'm not sure.
They're on skis.
Oh,
what, yeah. We don't really see them travel on skis. We see them just one panel, basically, swooshing down a slope, which is ridiculous in the best possible way. For me, it calls back to when Logan was surfing at that adamantium surfboard in X-Force 2526. A good kind of ridiculous. Just, it gave me like 5 minutes to stop reading and think about, would these characters actually ski? Like Domino. Domino could be on skis, right? She's got some extra luck. She always lands it just right. The avalanche never gets her. That's fine. Colossus on skis is just a horrible idea. I mean, he's made of, super dense metal. Logan has the adamantium bone, should make him sink way down into everything. It's just ridiculous, but, comic book fun kind of ridiculous. So our team of skiers runs across the dead, completely skinned carcass of a polar bear. And there is a cool panel where we can see someone lurking on a cliff above, hidden under the white pelt of that polar bear, which I didn't even notice the first time through. I had to go back and catch it. This is, of course, Saber Cap, and we get a pretty cool 4-page fight scene. Logan goes into full berserker mode, has to be restrained from killing Saber Cap by Colossus, because they want a prisoner alive for interrogation purposes. Now, the first attempt at interrogator is Sage, who does have low-level telepathy. That's been established. Too low-level to get through Sabercap's mental blocks. Maybe they have Red Triangle Protocol in Earth 203 where he's from. That's fine. Another competitor appears, and this is Phoebe Cuckoo. We'll remember that she joined the crew here at the end of X-Force 47 when Quentin rescued her from Sentinels and brought her to Krakoa farther north. Now, Quentin's dead now, or at least everyone seems to think so. We know his head is still alive in a box somewhere. So Phoebe is in a similarly poor emotional state to Aurora. And Sabercap's defenses are, they're nothing to her. She blasts right through them. Another very cool panel of her just forcing her way into his mind. That looked great. So our team gets to learn all about the multiversal Sabreteeth, where they came from, and about the original Sabretooth's experience in the Pit of Krakoa. There's something else lurking in Sabercap's mind, though. A bit of a psionic Trojan horse that's triggered by Phoebe's psychic interrogation.
Yeah, some kind of Sabretooth.
Say that again?
Some sort of Sabretooth, right? But I don't know. It's weird to me.
It's weird. It's got that pink color. And what it does, it takes Phoebe by surprise. It's only stopped when Domino blows Sabercap's saber brains right out at point-blank range. So he wasn't dead before. I'm pretty sure he's dead now. I expect to see a big old X through his face next issue. This is an oddly drawn panel here, just the one where he gets shot. His whole head is completely blacked out, like solid black inks, just his eyes, nostrils, and teeth visible. I kind of wonder if the original art was too gross for editorial and they sent it back for a quick revision, because it just looks weird. Maybe it had to be blacked out just to be, you know, too violent. Maybe there's too many brains being shown. It just doesn't look up to the art in the rest of the book. I'm curious what happened. And as Sabercap dies, Phoebe, and only Phoebe, sees a vision of Quentin apologizing for having been forced to plant that Trojan horse and also asking to be rescued. So I think what happened is that he's under the control of Sabretooth. He has a little bit of autonomy, at least when he's not being told to do something. So I think that Trojan horse was a psychic bomb made by Quentin. The color matches up. So here, as he, you know, he leaves the head because the head doesn't exist anymore, he says, you know, sorry about that. And he asks for help and says, send Wolverine. I could read this in two ways. Either Quentin, this is Quentin honestly asking for Logan's help, or it's a Sabretooth trick to get Logan there alone.
Yeah.
Could go either way. Do you have any thoughts on which way it might go? As I have some more tea.
I think it's a trick for sure. It'll give us another big fight. And then I think in the end, he'll have the third fight where he uses help, and that's when he wins.
That could be. And if it is a trap, Logan 100% falls for it. There's a lot in this issue. We haven't talked about it, but just a lot of the dialogue and just even the facial expressions, Logan is feeling super guilty for having once again failed everyone around him. Pretty standard Logan emotional trope. And for a few issues now, Percy's been setting it up that Logan had like a fatherly interest in Quentin specifically, which I don't know if that really existed in like the 95 issues of Ben Percy's Wolverine and X-Force that came before this, but he's leaning into it now. So Logan is fully primed to rush at any chance to rescue anyone, especially Quentin, which he seems to have totally forgotten about Laura in this, right? Laura's not even mentioned. We know Laura's being held hostage, or, you know, held captive at least.
Yeah.
Wolverine only knows that she's gone. I'm kind of surprised they didn't mention her here.
Well, they open the gift from
her,
right?
They do open the present, yes. While that interrogation's going on, Logan goes, weird timing, he goes and opens up that birthday present from Laura, which it's not a set of Mysterium knuckle dusters. No, no.
Yeah.
It's a world's best dad mug. But the note from Laura is saying, yeah, it's not really true, but hey, at least you're trying. Now, Ruben, how bad am I as a person for having laughed at this scene? Because I laughed at the scene. It's so emotionally manipulative right there. The world's best dad bug.
Yes.
It's funny.
It was funny. I did think it was also funny that in the middle of this, he's like, oh, this package. Might as well open to see what I got.
Yeah, not sticking around to see what Sabercap has to say about anything. I'm just going to open my birthday present. It is my birthday after all.
But if he didn't, everyone would be like, what the hell is in the box, right? So it's good.
Yeah, and it's done at just the emotionally most over-the-top time to do it. which again, all the emotions here are heightened. It's a Wolverine book. Everything's a little too much, but in a way that I'm enjoying. At this point, Logan jumps into the Bluebird, and as the issue closes, he heads off to confront Sabretooth on Krakoa. I'm not sure exactly how he knows to go to Krakoa specifically. Maybe Phoebe got that information out of Sabercap's brains, but we didn't see that happen on panel. Maybe that happened while Logan was opening his present. So another pretty fun issue of Wolverine. If last issue felt most like Victor Laval's story, this one is a whole lot more Ben Percy to me. His characters, his kind of gore, his kind of over-the-top silliness, that amazing skiing panel that I love so much, emotional stakes, a little overwrought, but fitting for the story. And I've already said lots of nice things about the art team of Corey Smith and Ori Jr. There's a panel where Sabercap leaps out at Domino that is really just fantastically done. I'd love a big picture of that. The psychic interrogation of Sabercap looked great. Somehow there are still six parts of the story to go, but hey, I'm starting to be a little more okay with that, and I'm going to give this issue another, call it 7.8 out of 10. Nothing earth-shattering, nothing that'll be remembered for decades and decades, but it's a cool, fun, violent Wolverine story, and sometimes that's good enough. How about you?
Yeah. Well, I finally get to be ahead of you or above you. I'm going to give it a solid 8. A lot of it's because I'm just surprised that I keep consistently enjoying a Wolverine book. The emotions were kind of obnoxious, especially to me, Aurora, like giving him some grief. I was like, okay, but whatever. I think I understand roughly like when you're in an emotional state, you don't always make the best rational decisions.
I just decided early on to just roll with those almost soap opera level emotions. Just say, okay, it's that kind of operatic story.
Yeah,
I'm just going to go with it. Once I kind of accepted that, it was just fun.
Yeah, but the hunt was fine. The action was cool. The art's pretty solid. So I enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy it as much. Like, I'm not going to think about this issue and what's going to happen next. But it was good. It was enjoyable. I think this is a pretty solid Wolverine story.
Yeah, and Ben Percy seems to really love this character. He talks about that in that interview. And so it's really cool that he gets to write like 100 issues worth of that. He's actually going to be doing another Wolverine story coming up in, I think, May. It's a sequel to the Wolverine Ghost Rider thing he did. I think it's called Helverine. Because, again, you take two words and you squish them together and you get a Marvel title. And it's going to be, again, Wolverine taken over by that same demon. So if you like that kind of thing, you're going to get some more of it.
I like
that. And that's Helverine. All the books we're going to talk about this week. Next we're going to talk about Resurrection of Magneto number 2 and Cable number 2 that have already come out. And we're going to talk about one new book coming out next week, which is X-Men number 32, which looks to be a Kitty Pryde and Magic with a K story. Some other books coming out next week that people might want to know about that we're not going to talk about are Ms. Marvel, Mutant Menace number 1. That's a lot of M's. If Ms. Marvel's mutant power is revealed, we will let you know about it. There's also going to be Weapon X-Men, number 1, speaking of Marvel words getting jammed together for a title. This is a 4-issue Christos Gage story, sequel to his one-shot original X-Men that came out in December, Multiversal, Multiple Logans. I think Jim's going to cover that on his podcast. Podcast will be maybe a little extra special this week, because I'm going to be joining Jim to talk about Ultimate X-Men, number 1, the Peach Momoko book set in Jonathan Hickman's Shiny New Earth 6160. I haven't read it yet, but I've liked everything else so far in that universe, so I have high hopes for it. And that's where we're going to wrap up today. I do believe that Ruben has disappeared into the multiverse / internet superhighway, so I'm going to sign off for him and say, hey, everybody, join us next week, and until then, read some more X-Men books. Bye-bye.